Okay, so this is lecture 10 of Standard Model and Beyond. So last time we just got to the end. We had written down the whole standard model, and we had also completely broken the standard model, so spontaneously broken the symmetry, and basically done a thorough analysis of the quadratic part of the Lagrangian to see what were the propagating modes, which ones were massive, which ones were massless, etc. And that was a very exciting moment. You all undoubtedly went home and just pondered for the past 2 weeks about how you had reached an important milestone in your life, which you had. And I congratulate you. Well, so I was gonna before you get too depressed that it's sometimes after a very elating. After moments of great elation, indeed, there can be kind of a followed by a depression because it seems like it's going to be all downhill from there. So you'll be happy to know that an important thing is that that model is known to be wrong. Okay, right at the end of the lecture, actually, I was imagining I was going to go straight into discussing the interactions in the standard model. But I think it may be instead, while we're discussing the quadratic parts of the Lagrangians, we should discuss how we know that the quadratic part of that Lagrangian is wrong. And basically, the problem is with neutrinos. We know the neutrino sector is wrong there. And somehow the first half of this course is supposed to be about the standard model, and the second half is supposed to be about beyond the standard model. But in spirit, really, the first half is supposed to be the description of, you know, what are the laws of nature as we know them, and then what are the speculations about what comes next, or at least explaining cosmological phenomena that we don't, maybe we know already exist, but we don't yet know the explanation for. In that light, even though the model that we finished introducing in the last lecture, or at least its quadratic part, is called the standard model. You know, again, it's now known to be wrong, definitively since the late 90s, since neutrinos were found to have mass. I'm going to introduce in this part of the course the sort of two alternative models, which, one of which, if you want, should be called the standard model, because they're the two most likely candidates to actually be correct, given what we currently know. They're the two most minimal explanations of what we actually observe at the moment. So I want to introduce those first, and then we'll get back to discussing all the interesting business about interactions in the standard model and those other theories. That way we'll be able to discuss them all at the same time. Okay, so what are the three models? Well, to introduce them, let's write once again my beloved table. See, I used to probably say when teaching this course, you know, you're probably sick of this table by now. But that's, if you're anything like me, that's not true. You're just growing to love it more and more. You're realizing it encapsulates a ton of deep facts about nature in a very small space of the blackboard, and all the mysteries that remain to be explained. And so you're loving it more and more. And so now I just say that it's my beloved table. And okay. So, great. But nevertheless, I'm sure it is boring to see me write it again and again, so I'll try to do that fast. Okay, so we have our quarks and our leptons, and they have the left-handed guys transform under SU2 and the right-handed guys don't. They have these weird hypercharges. We haven't even had a chance to talk about how weird those are or why there's a good explanation for them. We'll get there eventually. And then there's our scalar Higgs doublet here. Okay, great. So, and remember that so far we have been putting this row in parentheses and not using it. That row is not in the traditional standard model. Okay, so now with that table on the board, we can we want to carefully denumerate three models, okay? So model one is the standard model that we've been discussing. So just to repeat, that is the model where you take all of the lines in this table, excluding this line, and you write down all of the terms that you can, you write down the most general Lagrangian you can, built from those fields, with this gauge symmetry and Poincaré invariance, and dimension, and only terms that have mass dimension less than 4. The fields in them have mass dimension less than 4. So if you throw away the if you remove the coupling constants, the constants in front of the terms have dimension less than or equal to 4. So they're renormalizable. Okay, so in other words, this is the most general Lagrangian we get when we take our table and we don't include new right or terms of dimension greater than 4. Okay, that's the traditional standard model. And as I say, the only problem with that model is that we now know it to be wrong. It describes a hell of a lot of things right, but once you begin making sensitive enough measurements of the neutrino sector, it's not right. Okay, and we'll talk more about that shortly, and then later in the course. Okay, so the next thing is what I will call the standard model effective field theory, known by the rather unpleasant sounding acronym SMEFT. okay. So here, this is where we don't include, we take the most general Lagrangian that we can. We still don't include new right, but we drop this condition. We include all the terms, including terms dimensions 5 and higher. Okay, we allow all possible terms, but we still exclude new right. Okay, so same particles as in the standard model, but more terms in the Lagrangian. And then three I'll call the neutrino standard model, because here we add the right-handed neutrino to the model. So here, so it's the opposite. So here we drop, here we kept this condition, but we dropped this condition. In this model, we'll do the opposite. We'll keep this condition and drop this condition. Okay. So the neutrino standard model is where we don't include terms of dimension greater than 4, but we do include the right-handed neutrino. Now we write down the most general standard model we can. So do include dimension greater than 4, and do include the right-handed neutrino. Okay, so so what's the point of all of that? Well, so pros and cons of model number one. So model number one explains, as I say, a lot of laboratory experiments. It describes all laboratory experiments except those where you can measure neutrino oscillations. So on Earth and in the solar system, the only thing that it can't do is it can't explain the fact, which was in some sense observed since the 1960s, but was definitively observed in the late 1990s and early 2000s. It can't explain the fact that neutrinos have mass and oscillate. Okay, we'll discuss that more. But let me just... And then, once you look out into the cosmos, there's two important facts about the universe that, although they're not things that you can directly test, they're not, in some sense, not things where it directly fails a laboratory test here on Earth. They're facts about the cosmos where it now seems clear that this model does not contain an... This model, coupled to general relativity, coupled to Einstein's theory of gravity, cannot, on its own, explain those two things. So the first of those two things is dark matter. Or whatever, you know, there's some cosmological phenomenon that we observe that we don't know what's causing it. Most cosmologists think that what is causing it is some form of dark matter, some form of extra particle in the universe or extra matter component in the universe, which is causing additional gravitational attraction that we can't, that we don't yet know what its source is. I'll have a chance to discuss the evidence for that a little bit more later. But in any case, it could be something else. It could be that maybe there's no extra particles beyond the standard model, but gravity is modified somehow. But one way or another, this model, the standard model coupled to our ordinary theory of gravity, Einstein's general relativity, does not seem to give a compatible explanation for what the dark matter is. It doesn't seem to, in particular, if it is this standard model coupled to Einstein's theory of general relativity, then the only way to explain the dark matter is if there is some stable particle in the standard model that we haven't yet observed, some particle that can live for at least as long as the age of the universe, but we can't directly detect it except through its gravitational interactions. And well, there just is no particle like that left in the standard model. Okay, so it can't explain dark matter. And then it also can't explain, you know, the universe today. It's of course true on Earth and in the solar system, but now there's very good observational evidence that it's true even out to the scale of the part of the universe that we can observe today is made of matter, not antimatter. So there's a matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. So why is the universe made of matter rather than antimatter? You know, at some early, well, anyway, I'll get back to this later in the lecture, I suppose. But so the standard model can't explain that either. Okay, so those are the things that clearly can't be explained by the standard model. Now, there's other things which also can't be explained by the standard model, but I put them in a softer category since they have to do with the beginning of the universe in a region where we don't, this model has no right to necessarily apply anyway, and so that in principle we could add here also the origin of the perturbations in the early universe. This model can't explain that either, but that gets wrapped up with a question about how the universe was born, which let's maybe stay away from. So anyway, so model one, those are at least three things that model one can't explain. So the standard model effective field theory, this is the picture in which, well, we'll get to it, but the bottom line is that it very neatly explains the observed masses and oscillations of neutrinos. So it can explain point one here. but it still cannot explain these two guys. It doesn't help at all in these two departments. Okay, so it explains point one, but not points two or three. So in a sense, this is the model where this is the most conservative way to explore physics beyond the standard model, in some sense, in the sense that this is the Lagrangian you would get if you said, well, the high energy universe, the universe at very high energies or very tiny length scales may be described by some other fancier theory than this one. But at low energies, we seem to see that these symmetries are present and these fields are present. And so we should write down the effective low energy, effective field theory built from those degrees of freedom. And when we do that, the leading terms are the ones that have dimension less than or equal to 4, which is in some sense why we, to a first approximation, see the standard model as the correct theory. But if the effective field theory picture is right, then there should be all of these other terms in principle, the first leading correction being the dimension 5 term, then the dimension 5 terms, well, we'll see there's only one, but the dimension 5 terms and then the dimension 6 terms, et cetera. So in that sense, it's the most conservative picture, but it's also the one that it's the most conservative picture of beyond the standard model physics, but it's also the one that tells you the least about what's really going on beyond the standard model. What actually is going on, what the actual physical theory is at high energies, it could be anything. And it would still reduce to this theory at low energies, but by itself, this is not a complete theory. It's no longer a renormalizable Lagrangian. You can renormalize order by order in perturbation theory, but then every time you have to keep adding more and more terms in the Lagrangian, and so if you want to renormalize it up to infinitely many orders in perturbation theory, you end up having to add infinitely many terms with new coupling constants in the Lagrangian to do so. So it's the most conservative picture, but not a complete theory, okay? In the sense that it's not renormalizable and says I'm not going to speculate about what actually is happening at higher energies than the standard model.
Excuse me?
Yes?
So is the neutrinos mass the only success of this SM, or are there other...
So far, yes. So far, yes. Mm-hmm. And then finally, for the neutrino, for the standard model augmented by a right-handed neutrino in each generation, that does better in the following sense. So now it does explain points 1, 2, and 3. So it explains neutrino masses and oscillations because, as we'll see, it reduces at low energies to this explanation. It reduces to the standard model. When we integrate out the right-handed neutrino, we get a low energy effective field theory, which is exactly this. But it also, because it has introduced genuine new degrees of freedom here, the right-handed neutrinos, it turns out they are just what the doctor ordered to explain, to give a candidate for the dark matter and to give an explanation for how a still viable explanation for the where the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe came from. So I don't say that we know that these are the correct explanations, of course, but just that the model still gives a consistent explanation for problems 2 and 3. As I say, I said that already. Maybe I won't say it again to give myself a little more space here. So it reduces to the standard model effective field theory at low energies, as we'll see. And another important thing is that there are a number of very elegant, if only partial, ideas about what comes beyond the standard model, which take this kind of these hodgepodge of different elements and unify them into a single, much more elegant bit. And those very elegant explanations. Require the right-handed neutrino. So it sets the stage for elegant extensions / unifications of the standard model. So we'll discuss those in more detail in the second half of the course. But suffice it to say at the moment that and this is a renormalizable Lagrangian. Okay, it's complete to the same degree that this Lagrangian is complete. It has a finite number of terms, and then it can be renormalized without having to add any more terms to the Lagrangian. These two guys are complete in a sense that this guy is not. It doesn't in some sense push the new physics responsible for these phenomena off to an unknown higher stage. So my personal bet is that this theory is right, but we don't know that yet. Okay, at this point we have the fact that this guy explains this nicely is rather good evidence that this thing is probably more correct than this, and is probably a good low energy effective field theory describing our universe. This guy, the fact of the matter is that we have not directly detected or directly confirmed the existence of this right-handed neutrino yet. But as I'll try to expand upon, I think the evidence is sufficient that it's likely that it's there. I would say it's more likely than not that this model is correct. But anyway, that's where it stands. We can't say for sure. Okay, so basically I wanted to, so now I just wanted to basically introduce models 2 and 3 in a bit more detail in an attempt to, just get to know them a bit more. But before we do that, it'll be helpful. So I should also say, the standard model, if the standard model didn't include neutrino masses, it would just be much simpler to understand. This is the most confusing part of the standard model. You'll find that if you talk to professional physicists, unless they're specifically particle physicists, they almost certainly don't understand. They're almost certainly confused about the neutrino sector, and about Majorana neutrinos versus and the mass eigenstates and the flavor eigenstates. And so I'll try to make that clear over the course of the coming couple of lectures at the same time as we fold in the interactions. But anyway, just a warning, it's a confusing topic, but part of the confusion hopefully can be alleviated if we're careful at the beginning about getting clear about what the antiparticle field is of a given field and what Majorana neutrinos are and so on. So let's start with just a bit of generality about that. So we have our field psi. It is a Dirac spinner field. And so under a Lorentz transformation, where x mu goes to, you know, where the four vector x, the coordinates in Minkowski space, transform like x goes to lambda x, when we say this thing is a Dirac spinner, we mean that it transforms under some, this is a four component complex representation of the Lorentz group. So it transforms according to some particular 4x4 matrix U of lambda times psi. Okay, so that's how a Dirac spinner should transform. So now let's look at the complex conjugate of psi. How does it transform? Well, it no longer transforms, it's no longer a Dirac spinner because it doesn't transform right. So it transforms by, well, we complex conjugate this equation, so it transforms as U star of lambda, transforms to U star times psi star. Okay, but that is not equal to U of lambda. So this thing is not transforming like a Dirac spinner. But it turns out we can fix that. It almost is. It does up to a change of basis. So all we have to do is change basis as follows. We define the charge conjugate field, psi c, to be psi star, and then with a certain change of basis matrix in front, which is usually in a common convention taken to be minus I times the second Dirac gamma matrix, gamma 2. Okay, so I remind you that the Dirac gamma matrices in the basis that we're working in this course, the so-called Weyl basis, is a 4x4 matrix, which in block diagonal form has a 2x2 zero block, 2x2 zero block. And then here, up here, there's the Pauli sigma matrices, sigma mu, and sigma bar mu. Okay, this is the Weyl basis, where sigma mu, that's my notation, hopefully you've met, which is that this is a four index which runs from 0, 1, 2, 3. So for sigma 0 is just the identity matrix, the 2x2 identity matrix, and then sigma I for I goes to 1, 2, 3, those are the Pauli sigma matrices, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. So gamma 2 is the case where, and sigma bar is the case where we have 1, and then you flip the sign of the spatial components. Okay, so gamma 2 is the matrix where you have a sigma 2 and a minus sigma 2 here. Okay, so this thing, I will leave it as an exercise to check. Now this thing does transform right. So if we take psi c and transform it, well, according to this expression, it goes to I gamma 2 times U star of lambda psi star. But a simple exercise, I'm not going to write it on the board here explicitly, but if you look up what the representation looks like for the U of lambda for the Dirac spinner, you can check that if you commute this thing through, this is equal to U without the star of lambda times minus I gamma 2 psi star, or in other words, U of lambda times psi c. Okay, so psi c, unlike psi star, does transform like a Dirac spinner. Okay, so psi c is the version of complex conjugation which transforms still like a Dirac spinner. Okay, and so it's rather analogous to what we had before when we had our Higgs doublet, which transformed like a doublet under SU2, and then we wanted to work with the complex conjugate quantity, but we found, okay, well, so H transformed like H goes to some matrix U2 times H, and then we said, could we use H star? Well, no, we can't. It doesn't transform right. U2 star isn't equal to U2, but if we defined H twiddle, which is I sigma 2 times H star, then by a very analogous exercise, we can check that that does transform like U2 H twiddle. Okay, so it's very closely analogous, and in fact, it's very closely analogous because really the reason this works and the reason this works both boil down to the fact that, well, the Lorentz group turns out to be, there's this, when you're working out the group theory, the representations of the Lorentz group, you use the fact that it can be rewritten as SU2 times, the Lie algebra can be rewritten in a way that looks like SU2 times SU2. And so you're really making use of the same SU2, the same SU2 fact here and here, which is that the two-dimensional representation of SU2 is equal to its complex conjugate. But anyway, so that's ultimately what's behind. So when we take the charge conjugate of a field, we can split that into its left-handed and right-handed pieces. Okay, if we think of it as a four-component spinner, the upper two components are psi right, and the lower two components are psi left. Okay, but then that's I gamma 2 times psi star, so that's psi right star, psi left star. Okay, but I gamma 2, sorry, minus I gamma 2, what did I say? Minus I gamma 2. Minus I gamma 2, that's this off-diagonal matrix with a gamma 2 up, with a sigma 2 up here and a minus sigma 2 down here. So what you see is that, so that matrix, if we expand it out, that's minus I sigma 2 and plus I sigma 2, 0 times psi right star, psi left star. So because this matrix is off diagonal, what's that saying is that if you take a right-handed spinner and you take its charge conjugate in this way, it becomes a left chiral spinner. Okay, you start with a spinner whose upper two components are non-zero, and you take its complex conjugate and apply this change of basis to it, and you find you get a new guy whose lower two components are non-zero, and vice versa. Okay, so it converts left to right. Okay, so that's the thing to understand which will hopefully be helpful in understanding what I'm about to say. So now back to introducing the standard model effective field. Any questions about that? Okay, so So the standard model effective field theory. We did, you hopefully had a chance to give some thought to earlier in the course about why it is. So now we're working again. We're ignoring this line in the table. And previously we had gone through and tried to write down all of the terms with dimension 4 and lower that were completely invariant under both space-time and gauge symmetries. And now let's go one step beyond. Let's try to think about what dimension 5 term we can write down. Well, I'm not going to do the full exercise on the board. I encourage you to think about it, think through what possibilities you could write down. And what you'll find is that everything you try to think of that has only dimension 5 and is completely invariant under all the symmetries, well, everything will be ruled out. It either won't be invariant under one symmetry or another, or it'll end up having dimension greater than 5, so that at the end of the day, a famous observation due to Steven Weinberg is that there's only a single term at dimension 5 that you can write down in this theory, okay, the so-called Weinberg term. And so how do we write it down? Well, a nice way to think about it is the following. Let's define this new field psi, which is H twiddle dagger times new left. So times the left-handed lepton. Okay. So what is the point of this expression? Well, the thing to notice about this is that this guy is a singlet under, it doesn't transform under any of the standard model gauge symmetries. Okay, this guy doesn't transform under SU3, and this guy doesn't transform under SU3, so this whole thing doesn't transform under SU3. On the other hand, under SU2, this guy has a doublet index. H twiddle has a doublet index too that's contracted up with it, so the doublet indices cancel each other, so this thing is a singlet under SU2 also. And finally, under U1, well, this guy had charge -1/2. H twiddle also has charge -1/2, so when we take its dagger, that becomes a +1/2. So the U1 charges cancel also. Okay, so this thing is completely inert under the gauge symmetries. It doesn't transform. But it's not inert under space-time symmetries because this guy was a spinner field, so it carried a spinner index. Whereas this guy was a scalar field, it carries no space-time index. So this overall thing, all it has is just one leftover spinner index. Okay, so this thing transforms like a spinner field and nothing else. But notice that it has a different dimension, different mass dimension than an ordinary spinner field, because this was our ordinary normal spinner field with dimension 3/2. And then this guy is a scalar field. It has dimension 1, mass dimension 1. So this guy, this is a kind of weird spinner field with dimension 5/2. But anyway, just formally, let's write it down. And so now we can ask ourselves, can we build what terms can we write down? What's the simplest term we can write down? The lowest dimension term we can write down that is gauge invariant and built from this operator. Okay, well, we could try to ask, it's a spinner field, and we know that the simplest sort of Lorentz, you know, the only thing we need to eat up now, it just has a hanging Lorentz index, we have to eat that up. We know how to make Lorentz singlets, things that are invariant under the Lorentz group out of spinners. We always do something like psi bar psi. Well, we can't quite do that, because this guy was a left-handed spinner, so it only had its lower two components non-zero. But then again, the problem is that if we take a contraction like this of a left-handed spinner with itself, as we saw earlier, that's zero, because there's the gamma zero in the middle here is off diagonal, and so it means that the non-zero components from this guy and the non-zero components of this guy, you know, miss each other when they get contracted. So that would be zero. We can't write that down. But what we can do is we can define the charge conjugate spinner here. Okay, psi c, which is as usual, minus I gamma 2 of psi star, where now psi star is given by this expression. So now if we take psi c bar here, now that's non-zero because we're contracting a left-handed spinner with a right-handed spinner, because again, the taking the charge conjugate, like we were saying here, converts a left-handed spinner into a right-handed spinner. Okay, so this is a non-zero quantity. It's Lorentz invariant, and it's gauge invariant, because these two guys are both independently gauge invariant. They're both separately gauge invariant, okay? So now let's just check what the dimension is. Well, it's 5/2 plus 5/2 is 5. Okay, so that means that it's, you know, as expected, it's higher than dimension 4. That's why we didn't include it in our previous counting. And so to make it a term in the Lagrangian, we would have to add a term, we would have to put a coupling constant in, which has units of 1 over mass. Let's call the mass scale lambda. And now that's a dimension 4 term. That's a term we can add to the Lagrangian. And that turns out, again, to be the unique dimension 5 term you can add to the standard model Lagrangian. That's the Weinberg term. Okay, and now the point is that once you include this term, well, it turns out that that has two important consequences that we'll discuss. The first thing we want to see is that this gives a mass to the neutrino. Okay, so why is that? Well, okay, before I say that, let me say I was a little bit too quick here. So remember that this is really different, three different generations of neutrinos. I mean, this is three different generations of fields because this guy came in three different copies. So we really had three different psi's that we defined this way. And so here we have three different psi's contracted with three different psi's. And actually, we could have contracted psi 1 with psi 2 or psi 1 with psi 3 or psi 1 with psi 1. We could contract any guy with any guy. So there's a whole, there's really 9 possible terms here, and everyone can have a different coefficient. So we should really have a matrix here, psi ij. Okay, so that's the more correctly written Weinberg term. Okay, so that's a 3x3 matrix, analogous to the 3x3 Yukawa matrices we have been writing down when we write down the standard model. This is now a dimensionless complex 3x3 matrix. And it turns out there's another thing I should have said here, which is that also here we have to, this thing is not yet self-conjugate, we should add its Hermitian conjugate. Sorry about that, I forgot to add that. Okay, so sorry, that's the Weinberg term to make the Lagrangian real. The point is that as always, we want to ask what these things contribute to the quadratic. The first thing we want to ask is what do they contribute to the quadratic part of the Lagrangian? Well, you know, at the level of before spontaneous symmetry breaking, this guy does not contribute to the quadratic part of the Lagrangian because it involves 1, 2 times 2 fields. So it's a fourth order in the fields. So it's not a quadratic part. It doesn't look like a quadratic part of the Lagrangian. But you know, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, as we saw in the previous lecture, we have to reassess. And so here, actually, if you think about it, when we insert, you know, when we do spontaneous symmetry breaking, we replace H twiddle here by, you know, the vacuum expectation value part plus the Higgs boson capital H, and then we have to reassess which terms are quadratic once we just treat the vacuum expectation value part as a constant. And so what happens here is that when we do that, we do get a part that's quadratic in the fields, namely the part where we just substitute the VEV, or H twiddle, where it appears both here and here. And so when we do that, this term becomes, so if we just keep the, let's say, if we just keep the VEV part, then we get the quadratic term, which looks like minus 1/2 times new left bar C times a 3x3 matrix Mij times new left J plus Hermitian conjugate, where this guy is just here. I've remember we took H and substituted 1 over root 2 times V for each of those. So we get two, we get a V squared over 2 here. And then this whole thing can be combined with this guy. So the, in other words, Mij, the mass matrix appearing here, is just V squared over 2 lambda times the dimensionless matrix Yij. And this now has dimensions of mass because V has dimensions of mass and lambda has dimensions of mass. So mass squared over mass, this thing is now a dimensionful mass matrix. But now, a simple exercise, but slightly too painful to do on the blackboard, but not much. I mean, it's really simple and you should check it, is that if you define, is that this is equal to minus 1/2 nu bar. Okay, let me just go to matrix notation here. So I'll suppress these indices I and j. So this expression then becomes equal to nu bar m nu, where I've defined the, so here I had nu left with a left. Here I've dropped the left. This nu, I'm sorry, I haven't dropped the left. I've defined a new field nu is what I mean to say, which is a Dirac neutrino, a four-component neutrino with the which is just nu left plus nu left C. Or in other words, written in four-component notation, the bottom two components are nu left, and the top two components are nu left C. Okay, so in other words, this looks just like now the mass term for a Dirac neutrino. Remember, the mass term for a Dirac neutrino usually just looks like minus psi bar m psi, something like that. Well, this looks just like that, except there's this 1/2 in front. Okay, well, we'll get to that in a second. That's a detailed point. But so this is but other than that, these two terms look the same. The only difference is that in an ordinary Dirac neutrino, the psi left and psi right, the lower two components and the top two components, are independent fields. I mean, these are just four distinct complex numbers that are a priori unrelated to one another and can be chosen independently of each point in space-time. But here, once I know the bottom two components of this four-component vector, I can determine the top two components because I know they're just related by this equation, this sort of equation over here, that, you know, they're just related by minus I gamma 2 times psi star. So these are no longer independent components. They're, once I know the bottom two, the top two are fixed. So this kind of neutrino, this sort of four-component neutrino which satisfies this extra condition, is called this sort of fermion, I should say, is called a Majorana fermion. And so what we've learned is that in the standard model effective field theory, the left-handed neutrino, which in the ordinary standard model had zero mass, now turns out to have to be a once you think of it as a Majorana fermion, does turn out to have a so-called Majorana mass. Okay, that's the main point I wanted to make. Oh, maybe I'll just say one other thing here. A little bit more explanation about Majorana fermions. You know, so what's the deal about Majorana fermions? Well, one way to Majorana. You know, it's like with scalar field. If you have a scalar field, you could have a real scalar field, which is just a single real component above each point in space-time, a single real number above each point in space-time. And then when you go to quantize it, you find that it's when you expand it in terms of positive and negative frequency solutions of the Dirac equation of the Klein-Gordon equation of its equation of motion. So there's some the details are not important, but I'm just the point that I want to make is that you expand it in terms of a basis of solutions of its equation of motion, and you put an annihilation operator. I mean, hopefully these are reminiscent of details that you've encountered in your QFT course. But as I say, the details at the moment are not what I'm trying to get across. When you quantize this real scalar field, you expand the field in terms of its a basis of solutions, and there's the positive frequency solutions and the negative frequency solutions. Okay, so there's solutions that look like e to the I p dot x minus omega t, where omega is positive, and they get an annihilation operator, a sub t, in front of them. And then there's the corresponding negative frequency solutions. And they get an a dagger sub p. Okay, so in a real scalar field, the annihilation operators in front of the positive frequency solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation are the daggers of the operators appearing in front of the negative scalar field, negative frequency solutions of the scalar field equation of motion. And that is in order to satisfy this constraint that this is a real field, so it has to satisfy phi dagger equals phi. Alternatively, if we consider a complex scalar field doesn't satisfy this condition, then when we quantize, we find that we have to put two independent operators here. So there's the annihilation operator for the particle here in front of the positive frequency solutions, and there's the creation operator for the antiparticle in front of the corresponding negative frequency solutions. And for a complex field, these are independent operators. They're not related by Hermitian conjugation. And so that's saying that the particles and antiparticles of this field are independent particles when it's a complex field. Okay, but we can get back to, in the scalar field case, again, we just get back to the real, we just now impose this condition, phi dagger phi, and that ends up forcing these two to be the same again. And so now when you impose this condition, this is a theory whose particles and antiparticles are the same. There's no distinction between particle and antiparticle. So now with a fermion field, the story just gets a little fancier. Now you have to sum over spin up and spin down, but ultimately there's an analogous thing. Psi is analogous to the complex scalar field phi. Okay, it just has an extra spin degree of freedom you have to keep track of. So there's some sum over spins here when you're doing the expansion. But the bottom line is that again, you have the positive frequency solutions here, U of P's times e to the I dot dot dot. And then you have the negative frequency solutions, V of P times e to the minus I dot 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 dot. And again, here you have to put in front A of momentum P and spin sigma. And here, because it's a complex field, you put in front, a priori, it's an independent, an operator, B dagger of P and sigma. So that's just saying that the particles of momentum P and spin sigma are different particles than the antiparticles of momentum P and spin sigma. Okay, but then what would the analogous condition be here that would make, well, over here we had this condition we could impose that related psi to its complex conjugate and that had the property of also making the antiparticles no longer different from the particles, no longer an independent particle. Well, over here, we can't just impose the, as we said, we can't just impose the condition psi dagger equals psi, because that's not compatible with Lorentz invariance. The two sides here transform differently. But instead, we impose the condition psi c is equal to psi. That is, now that is compatible with Lorentz invariance. And that condition, again, just exactly means that A and B are no longer independent. B is equal to A. Okay, so, but this field exactly satisfies that property. Okay, if you just apply, if nu has this form, where the top and bottom two components are already connected in this way, now when we compute nu sub c, in other words, we take minus I gamma 2 times the star of this, we'll just find that nothing happens. We get the same expression back. Okay, so nu is exactly a field of this form. It's a Majorana neutrino. Its particles and antiparticles aren't independent of each other. That's what we mean when we say it's a Majorana neutrino. Okay? Sorry, I belabored the point just because everybody finds it confusing. You're an anomaly if you don't find it confusing. Okay, so let's see. So to just finish off the standard model effective field theory with one additional comment. We wrote down the standard model, which were all the terms up to dimension 4. And we wrote down all the terms that were invariant under these symmetries. But actually, once we write down all of those terms, they turn out to have two other symmetries that we didn't bargain for. Okay? Which are baryon number and lepton number. Okay, but they're not gauge symmetries, they're just global symmetries. Okay, but if we write down the standard model Lagrangian, we find actually there's two other columns of symmetries in this table, which we just get for free as an accident. Okay, there's baryon number, which is the U1 charge, which is another U1 charge here. Let's call it U1 baryon number. So this was U1 hypercharge, and these are the hypercharges. But there's another symmetry, U1 baryon number, where the baryon numbers for all of the quarks are 1/3. And the baryon numbers for all of the leptons are 0. Okay, and also the Higgs boson has 0 lepton number, baryon number. And then there's the lepton number, U1 lepton. And now the quarks all have 0 lepton number, as does the Higgs, but the leptons, as you might expect, have non-zero lepton number. They have lepton number 1. Okay, so if you try a U1 transformation, using these charges and apply it to any term in the standard model, you'll find it's invariant. And similarly, if you take this term and apply this transformation to any term in the standard model, you'll find it's invariant. Okay, so there are these two other symmetries that seem to appear out of nowhere in this Lagrangian. And what I want to say is that, but then when we wrote down the dimension 5 term here, the first term that we wrote down broke this lepton number symmetry. Okay, so if you try to apply that symmetry, due to lack of time, I won't do this on the board right now, but if you try to apply that symmetry to the Weinberg term up there, you'll find it's not a symmetry because the left-handed guy, the psi on the right, picks up a certain charge and the guy on the right instead of picking up the canceling charge, picks up the same charge again. So the charges add, and they don't add up to zero. The lepton phase doesn't add up to zero in that term. So at dimension five, so in standard model effective field theory, once we include a dimension five term, the Weinberg term, that breaks lepton number. So lepton number seems to be a conserved quantity at low energies, but once we add the dimension five term, we see it's not strictly conserved. It's only very, very approximately, very, very well approximately conserved. And then if we went further and went to dimension six, which we won't do, then there turns out there's a lot of terms, but the bottom line is that you get terms that break baryon number as well. And so when you break baryon number, that means baryon number is the thing that prevents the proton from decaying. The proton carries non-zero baryon number. It has baryon number plus one because it's made of three quarks. And so it can't decay because there's no lighter particle with baryon number that it can decay into. So baryon, it can't decay and also conserve energy momentum and baryon number at the same time. Okay, but the dimension six terms in the standard model predict baryon number is no longer a strictly conserved quantity. And so they predict that at some level that we haven't yet detected, that baryon number should be violated and that the proton should not be exactly stable. So I think it's as I say, we've already confirmed that this term is present. I think it's a very, very good bet that it's also true that the proton, that the matter that we're made of is not strictly stable and that the proton decays, but with some stupendously long lifetime that we haven't yet detected. Okay, so then I'll pick up with item three there, the neutrino standard model next time, because I'm already a couple of minutes over. Any questions about any of that? Yeah.
You said the proton wasn't stable?
Very likely, although nobody has ever seen a proton decay so far.
But it's made of baryons, right?
Mm-hmm. And the proton is a baryon. Yes.
The dimension six terms that would make the proton stable, or the dimension five term?
So the dimension five term, which is the one that we've already discussed, which is in some sense the one that you would expect to see, the deviation from the simplest standard model that you would expect to see first, we have seen that. And that is responsible for the fact that we've observed neutrinos to have masses. Now, it actually makes other predictions that we still haven't seen, which I'll get a chance to mention later, but which people are still looking for. There's something called neutrinoless double beta decay, which people haven't seen yet. And then there's neutrino oscillations, which people have already seen, which, again, are a prediction of this term. So this term is confirmed observationally to be there, I would say. This term, by the same logic, you would imagine that at the next, the next easiest to detect deviations from the standard model would be these dimensions, would be coming from these dimension six terms. But those are sufficiently, but you would also predict that given how hard it was to detect these, it's not implausible, you know, so these will be even harder to detect. And now how hard they will be to detect is hard to say a priori. So in fact, famously, certain models of beyond the standard model physics predict that we should have seen this already, and so those models got ruled out. And then others predict that we shouldn't have seen it already. But the bottom line is that at some level, if you believe that these dimension six terms are really there as the next step in the process that gave us these terms, and which was the next step in the process that gave us the standard model terms, then yes, these are the terms, the dimension six terms are the first ones that predict proton, and hence you and I ultimately must decay. But again, the lifetime for the proton, there's already a lower bound. People search for it experimentally, and there's already a lower bound. So the expected time that a given proton lives can't be shorter than, I think it's 10 to the 35 years or something like that. Where by comparison, you know, so the universe is 10 to the 10 years old. So that's already pretty old, you know, that's pretty long. And so, but we know that protons have to live at least 10 to the, I might be getting the number wrong, but it's a lot longer than that. Okay, so because you can do experiments where you sit and stare at tons of protons, you can find that the decay rate of an individual proton has to be much, 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 much longer even than the current age of the universe. So, so it's something like 10 to the 34 years is the lower bound on the age of the proton. But it might not be much. It might not. There's also good reasons to expect that it might not be much greater than this. Like it might be within a factor of a few of this, and so actually within a factor of a few of ongoing experiments to detect it. But we don't know. All right. Okay. Well, I don't want to keep you too long today.